I still dream about her sometimes. Marshmallow. A fat white cat with one blue eye and one green. She used to curl up on my chest when I was 10. I once left the garage door open by accident. She wandered out and got hit by a car. I was the last to see her alive. I remember her limp body, still warm, and the unbearable sound my sister made when she found out. I swore I saw her ghost for a year after. And maybe I did. I've never forgiven myself. I'm 25 now, and I guess guilt doesn't die. It just shapeshifts. Like the weird-ass trip I had last month in Lisbon. Or maybe Porto. Honestly, the city's blurred by day 3. What I do remember is the hostel. A crumbling pastel building with a rooftop view and bunk beds that smelled like beer and secrets. It was the last night on our pub crawl, and everyone was high on cheap sangria, tourist energy, and this weird green liqueur the locals called Liqueur Biro, or something like that. That night I was on a streak. I'd made out with a Swiss girl in an elevator, outdrank an Australian dude named Milo, and was now deep in flirt mode with this gorgeous chick from Quebec named Camille. She had this accent that made even dumb shit sound sexy.
You are so, how you say, stupid but cute.
She giggled, tucking her red hair behind her ear.
Let's go somewhere.
The hostel's common room was mostly empty, except for two Germans having a serious whisper fight over Spotify controls. Camille came very close, quick and sharp, then tugged at my hand.
Let's get a room nearby. I want you with all of these bunk beds and sweaty people, she said.
I went to pee before we left. And that's when things shifted. The lights in the hallway were out. I was half drunk, barefoot, and giggling to myself like an idiot. I walked past the kitchen when something brushed my leg. Then, bang! I felt the sharp burning pain just above my ankle. I yelled, stumbling back. I flicked on my phone flashlight. It was the hostel's cat. Black, skinny, twitchy. Its pupils were huge, like two bottomless wells. It hissed and bolted. Blood trickled down my leg. When I limped back, Camille laughed.
Did you fight a vampire?
The cat bit me, like properly punctured my ankle. She shrugged.
It's probably vaccinated. You okay?
Yeah. I lied. I didn't want to ruin the night. We walked into a dingy little hotel nearby and checked into a room with a broken lamp and a mirror that made you look 10 pounds fatter. We made out and got halfway to something fun, but the pain in my leg was growing louder than anything else. By 3 a.m., my leg was visibly swelling. By 4 a.m., I couldn't walk on it. My whole shin looked like a red balloon with a grudge. Camille was asleep, and I didn't want to freak her out. So I googled in the bathroom with my pants down and heart racing. Cat scratch fever. Pasteurella multicida. Risk of sepsis. Limb amputation. I dry heaved. I limped back into bed. The room had this strange scent. Not just drops of passion and sweat, but something sour and wrong. I swear I heard purring, but the hotel didn't have a cat. I tried to sleep. But I ended up having the weirdest dream. Marshmallow was there, sitting on my chest again. Only this time, she was whispering in a language I didn't understand. Her eyes weren't mismatched anymore. They were glowing red. Behind her was the black cat from the hostel. And something, someone, standing in the shadows humming a lullaby. I woke up sweating. Camille was gone. I mean, completely gone. No bag, no clothes, no note. Just a faint red line scratched into the bedsheet beside me. I blinked. My leg was worse. I tried to stand and almost passed down. Panicked, I hobbled down to reception. The clerk stared at my leg and immediately called an ambulance. The ride to the hospital was a blur. IVs, shouting in Portuguese, questions about rabies. They pumped me with antibiotics and took blood samples. A doctor with tired eyes leaned over me and said,
"You're lucky. Another 12 hours and we might have had to cut."
In the hospital bed, I kept thinking about Marshmallow, the cat bite, Camille, that scratch on the sheet. I called the hostel.
"Camille just checked out,"
and our cat died last week.
The girl at the desk told me. I froze. What do you mean died?
She got out one night. Someone left the back door open. Got hit by a car. It was bad.
My mouth went dry.
Are you okay, sir? She asked.
Yeah. I lied again and hung up. Later, a nurse handed me my bag.
This fell out, she said, holding up a small object.
It was a cat collar, black, with a little silver bell. I'd never seen it before. I asked around. No one knew how it got there. I flew home 2 days later, with a heavy limp and a fever that clung for weeks. No one believed the story, of course. They said I hallucinated, that Camille ghosted me, that I probably imagined the collar. But sometimes, late at night, I hear a bell jingle in the hallway. Once, I found a scratch on my bedsheet, the same faint red line. And last week, I opened my front door to find a paw print in the snow. Just one. Marshmallow still visits. And I think she brought friends. I don't drink much anymore, and I always keep the doors locked. But the thing is, if you've ever wronged a cat, truly wronged her, she doesn't forget, and she doesn't forgive, not even after death. This story is inspired from a real-life event which was shared with me by one of the Broccoli Fam subscribers. I was staying at an Airbnb in the heart of Barcelona, around 1 a.m., a little tipsy and half asleep. I wandered toward the bathroom in the dark, and that's when it happened. The host cat, likely startled, sank its teeth into my foot. It was supposedly vaccinated, so I brushed it off as nothing serious at the time. I'd never heard of cat scratch fever before, but a few hours later, my leg began acting up in a way that felt ominous. It became stiff, incredibly sore, and ballooned up like it was trying to win a parade float contest. The bite had punctured right over a major vein, and the infection was spreading fast, like horror movie fast. Out of panic, I turned to the internet. Big mistake. The results were full of terms like near amputation and 2-week hospital stay, and suddenly my upcoming flight felt like the least of my worries. Thankfully, I was fine eventually. The only person I ever truly hated was my old college roommate, Jackson. We were both sophomores at a small arts college in Maine. He was my first friend there, and I really thought he liked me. I sure liked him. Even though he was a lot more outgoing and less serious than me, we did everything together. Toward the end of our first semester, the school threw a dance for the underclassmen. Jackson was friends with our student government, so he volunteered to help set it up. For a week before the event, he'd returned to the dorms with updates on the dance. He told me about the circus-themed decorations he'd helped put up, the face-painting supplies, all the weird decisions that the student government kept making. Apparently, the dance hall was being redesigned as a 3-ring circus tent, and no one was allowed inside unless they were in clown costumes. I thought it sounded like a stupid idea, but if Jackson was going to go, then I would too. He was the kind of guy who made everything more fun. He even bought me a clown suit to match his. On the day of the dance, we were supposed to get ready together, but he texted me that he'd have to get there early to help set up. I put on my clown costume alone and then headed across campus. As soon as I pushed open the front doors, I realized that something was very, very wrong. The dance hall looked as fancy and formal as always. All my classmates were inside, and they were all wearing tuxes and ball gowns. No circus theme, no clowns. And every single person turned to look at me, wearing my polka dot jumpsuit, giant shoes, and bright red nose. The laughter started immediately. It was the single most humiliating moment of my entire life. I felt like the biggest idiot in the world. And the loudest laughter came from Jackson, my supposed friend, who stood in the crowd wearing a nice black suit. He'd set me up. I ran back to the dorms crying, clown makeup running down my face. I packed up my stuff and left. I officially dropped out of school later that week. Jackson called me a bunch of times, but I didn't answer his calls. I listened to his voice messages, though, and they definitely didn't help.
Come on, man. It was just a joke. Don't be so butthurt.
I took a year off from school. It took a lot of time and a lot of therapy to regain my confidence. I ended up enrolling at a different school and studied psychology. I became a therapist myself, vowing to help people overcome trauma like my own therapist had done for me. Years passed and my life was pretty great. I stopped thinking about Jackson altogether, finally free from all the embarrassment. Then the unthinkable happened. Jackson showed up in my office as a new patient. He didn't even recognize me. I changed so much from when I was a skinny 19-year-old. I really got in shape. I grew a beard, and I shaved off all my hair to hide my growing baldness. I looked like a completely different person. Meanwhile, Jackson looked exactly the same, though his goofiness had been replaced by melancholy. He was divorced and stuck in a dead-end job. In our first session, I expected him to eventually figure out who I was, but he never did. I treated him like a regular client, even though the sight of him was bringing back all my bad memories. After that first session, I came to a dark conclusion. It wasn't a coincidence that Jackson had found me. It was fate, and it was my opportunity to finally have my revenge. In our second session, I convinced him to try hypnotherapy to get to the root of his problems. It took a lot of convincing, but he finally gave in. He really trusted me. So after that, I put him into a trance at the beginning of each session, planting suggestions into his subconscious. I told him to think of clowns. I told him that clowns were lurking around every corner, that soon they would find him and hurt him. To a normal person, this trick wouldn't work. But because Jackson had this lingering guilt of his clown prank on me, my suggestions tapped into his subconscious. It didn't take long for him to develop a fear of clowns. In our next sessions, after I pulled him out of his trance, he told me how he was seeing clowns everywhere he went. In mirrors, on the street, staring at him through half-open doors. Why do you think that is? Is there something from your past that would explain why clowns are after you? He looked up at me, eyes filled with tears, and he told me about the prank he'd done all those years ago. He looked guilty, broken, as he described his prank in excruciating detail. I thought it was just a joke, but my roommate was so mortified that he dropped out of school. I feel so guilty about it. I always have. I guess I deserve this. In that moment, all my lingering anger disappeared. He looked helpless, broken. And did you ever apologize to him? I tried, but he was already gone before I realized how much I messed up. And I'll never find him. I can't even remember his name. He had no idea that he was sitting across from the person he desperately wanted to see. I could have introduced myself right then, but I didn't. Instead, I told him, "Your friend, whoever his name is, has probably moved on with his life. You should too." I continued to have sessions with him after that, but I stopped hypnotizing him. And when he brought up his continued clown hallucinations, I always assured him that it was all in his head. He needed to move on. I saw him twice a week for the next couple months, but he wasn't getting better. He still saw clowns wherever he looked. He told me that he even called the police a few times, certain that clowns were lurking outside his house. It didn't matter what I said now. I planted the fear in his brain, and that fear just got worse and worse. Eventually, I decided to finally tell him who I really was. I wouldn't admit to the hypnosis trick, but I thought if he knew who I was, if he knew I forgave him, then he'd get some peace of mind. Unfortunately, he didn't show up for his next appointment, or his appointment after that. My secretary called him, but he never answered. After a week, I saw his name show up on my newsfeed. He was found wandering naked around his neighborhood, brandishing a knife and screaming about clowns everywhere. He's in a mental hospital now. He finally snapped. My revenge went a bit too far, I guess. I might go and visit him in the hospital. I might tell him the truth. But then again, I might not.
I haven't decided yet. The story is loosely inspired from a real-world event. In September 2016, during a bizarre wave of clown sightings across the American South, a Georgia couple added fuel to the fire, but with a twist. Brandon Moody called 911, claiming to see clowns near a white van in Troup County. When police found no trace of suspicious activity, Moody changed his story, eventually confessing he fabricated the incident. His sister-in-law, Rebecca Moody, also made a separate false clown report. The prank turned criminal. Both were arrested and charged with obstruction and unlawful conduct during a 911 call. Authorities reaffirmed a zero-tolerance stance on hoax reports amid growing public fear.
I joined the running club because I needed something regular, something to keep me going after work besides just scrolling through apps or eating frozen dinners alone. At first, it was about getting fit. Then, it became something else. I mean, I'd be lying if I said there weren't tons of attractive women in the group. We'd talk before warm-ups, after cool-downs, sometimes over coffee. It felt natural. I never pushed anything. If I felt a vibe, I'd ask if they wanted to go do something outside the group. Grab a bite, see a band, whatever. Most said no. Some ghosted me. After a while, it got to me. Rejection stings, even when you pretend it doesn't. Then she showed up. Her name was Rachel. Wavy brown hair. Freckles. Toned, but not showy. She wore a Guns N' Roses tee on her first run, and I teased her about it the next day. Didn't peg you as a classic rock chick, I said. Didn't peg you as someone who'd say peg in a sentence, she smirked. It was flirtatious, quick-witted. She kept pace with me every morning. After the runs, while most people rushed off, we stayed back, sipping coffee, laughing about dumb stuff like how awful the playlist was, or how Barry always ran with his shirt off like it was 1999. Within a few weeks, it was routine. Me and her, side by side at the cafe. No pressure. She didn't say no when I offered her a ride once. She laughed my stories. She touched my arm when she laughed. I thought, this is it. After 6 weeks, I invited her over for a movie night. You in for some horror and whiskey? I texted. She replied with a laughing emoji. Only if there's popcorn. That night, I prepped. Cleaned the place. Got her favorite bourbon. Even made popcorn from scratch. I laid out the stuff, too. My toys. The leather cuffs, the silk rope, the blindfold. I mean, we hadn't talked about it yet, but the chemistry was real. The signs were there, clearly. She came over in a hoodie and leggings. Casual, I like that. We watched The Witch. She kept jumping at the tense parts, pulling her knees up like a kid. It was cute. After the credits rolled, I paused the screen and looked at her. You want to do something a little more fun? She looked at me, half smiling. What do you mean? I stood up, walked to the shelf, and brought the box over, set it on the table, opened it. She looked at it, then at me. Let's start, I said. My voice was slow, steady, confident. Her smile faded. No, she said. I don't want to. It's fine, I said. It's just roleplay stuff. You'll like it. She stood up, backing slightly. I said no. I tried to laugh it off. Don't be scared. You trust me, right? She moved toward the door. I think I should go. Something inside me snapped. I grabbed her by the shoulders. Please stay. Don't freak out. She pushed at my chest. Let go! I slapped her. I didn't mean to. My hand moved before my brain caught up. Her face turned, red blooming across her cheek. She froze. My hands were shaking. I didn't mean... I started. But she lifted a finger. Shh. Her expression changed. She wasn't scared anymore. She was calm, controlled, like she'd seen this before. You want me to stay? She asked. I nodded, desperate. She walked to my speaker, put on a sultry track. Portishead, I think. She started moving. Slowly. Hypnotically. She danced like she'd done it 1,000 times. I was lost in her rhythm. Every step pulled me in deeper. She poured me a glass, then another. Whiskey turned to syrup in my mouth. My head swam. She sat on my lap, kissed my forehead. Relax. Then, nothing. When I woke up, it was dark. I was lying on something hard. My mouth was taped. Hands and legs tied. I couldn't move. The air smelled like cardboard and motor oil. My head throbbed. I heard voices. This one's going to Mexico. Another voice laughed. Ha ha! Hope he speaks Spanish. I screamed through the tape, kicked, wriggled. No one came. The walls vibrated as the vehicle moved. A container truck. My body bounced with each pothole. I cried, really cried, for the first time in years. My nose was bleeding. My wrists burned from the rope. I kept thinking, why? Why me? Then the answer came clear. Because I deserved it. The container rattled. Hours passed. I lost track of time. My phone was gone. My ID, too. They'd erased me. I wasn't even a person anymore. Just cargo. This incident has been inspired from a real-life incident shared by our subscriber's friend. So his friend joined a running group, and this is what he said. I'm a guy, and honestly, there are quite a few women in my running group I find attractive. If it ever feels like there's mutual interest, I usually try to suggest hanging out beyond the runs. Sometimes one-on-one, sometimes in a group. I'm always respectful and back off if they don't seem into it. But in my opinion, a running club is actually a pretty solid way to meet someone. I mean, where else are you supposed to go to meet new people these days? And in real life, his friend was not a creep and approached the women with respect. I never really cared about bee pollen until I started working at Denny's on Route 47. It wasn't the most glamorous place to sling hash browns and pancakes, but the tips were decent, and the people were, at first glance, friendly. Then came the phase. It started with Kayla, a line cook who had recently dumped her boyfriend and gained 6 pounds in emotional fallout. One morning, she came in waving a yellow jar like it was holy water. Bee pollen, she whispered like it was a secret. Thermogenesis! Fat-melting magic! I snorted. What's thermogenesis? It makes your body burn calories just existing, she said, tapping her temple like she'd unlocked the code to human biology. Like, your internal temperature rises, and bam! Fat gone! By the end of the week, half the kitchen staff was popping those yellow grains like Adderall. They sprinkled it in smoothies, chased it with lemon water, even snorted it once on a dare. Everyone swore they were shedding pounds. But what really lit the fire was our manager, Bruce. Bruce was a red-faced ex-Marine who never quite left boot camp behind. He barked instead of spoke and had zero filter. If you ate fries on your break, he'd yell across the restaurant, "That's going straight to your ass!" If you gained weight, he'd pinch your stomach and shout, "Winter's over! Hibernate on your own time!" One afternoon, I was leaning against the freezer, gnawing on a peanut butter sandwich when he came up behind me. He grabbed my upper arm, gave it a squeeze, and literally screamed, "Holy shit, Lisa, what are you eating? Cement?" I froze. My cheeks flushed. Everyone laughed, even Kayla. I didn't eat for the rest of my shift. It got worse. Bee pollen became mandatory. Bruce started buying it in bulk and leaving jars in the break room with labels like "Fat Burn Gold" and "No Excuses." He'd point to it during meetings. "We are a clean, sharp-looking team," he'd say. "No one wants to be served by a double chin. You represent this brand." We didn't represent Denny's. We represented his eating disorder. 3 weeks in, Kayla collapsed during her shift. She had been running orders like usual when she just dropped, like someone unplugged her. We all thought it was dehydration. Turned out, her blood sugar had bottomed out. The ER doc said her caloric intake for the week had been barely survival level. Bruce laughed when he heard. "Guess she detoxed too hard, huh?" I wanted to slap him. Instead, I started planning. The idea came while I was taking the trash out. I passed the back alley and saw Bruce with one of the servers, Jessica. She was 21. He was 47, married. When they pulled apart, I stayed quiet in the shadows. "I don't want to hide it anymore," she said. "You think I can divorce my wife for a girl who eats breadsticks?" he growled. "Keep taking the bee pollen. Tighten up." That night, I messaged Jessica anonymously through a fake Instagram profile. I told her everything. I told her I'd heard him say the same thing to two other girls. I told her he had cameras in the staff locker room. That part wasn't true, but I needed her angry. She blocked him the next day. By the weekend, she had quit. Bruce didn't handle rejection well. A week later, he installed a new rule: weigh-ins. He brought a digital scale and put it in the break room next to the time clock. "You don't have to do it," he said, smiling with too many teeth, "but it sure looked good for anyone wanting that next raise." Everyone stepped on, except me.
"Why not?"
he asked, loud enough for the whole line to hear. "Because I have dignity," I said, "unlike your marriage." Dead silence. He didn't fire me. He promoted me. That's when things got weird. He started calling me into his office more often. Not to discipline me, but to talk. He'd offer me a protein shake and ramble about how the government was poisoning the food supply, how bee pollen was nature's vaccine. He'd vent about his wife, about Jessica, about the lazy fat kids in the world. I just nodded and smiled. One night, after a close, I stayed late to finish the books. Bruce said he'd lock up, but I saw his truck still parked when I came out 30 minutes later. The kitchen lights were on. I peeked through the glass. He was in the walk-in freezer, shirtless, drenched in sweat, jogging in place. A jar of bee pollen spilled open beside him. His eyes were wild. There were sticky notes on the wall. "Burn it off! Jessica will come back! Fat is failure!" I backed away, breath shallow. This wasn't a diet. It was madness. I couldn't sleep that night. Something about the desperation in his eyes. It wasn't just narcissism. It was dangerous, contagious madness. I texted Kayla. "Want to ruin him?" She wrote back instantly, "Tell me where to start." 2 weeks later, it was a Tuesday, slow shift. I was on grill, slapping pancakes like they owed me money, when the bell jingled and in walked Jessica. Hair bleached, new lip filler, nails like switchblades. Everyone turned. She strutted in like it was a runway, gave Bruce a nod, and slid into a booth. Kayla muttered, "What the hell is she doing here?" Jessica had no apron, no uniform. But 20 minutes later, Bruce handed her one. She was rehired, just like that.
"Second chances," he said, clapping his meaty hands. "We all deserve them."
No one clapped back. By the end of her first shift, Jessica was in the office. By the end of the week, they were riding to work together. She had her old section back. Her tips were higher than ever, and Bruce suddenly had amnesia about the weight checks and fat-shaming speeches. It was like she'd cast a spell on him. And maybe she had. Because the plan, the one Kayla and I spent nights whispering about, recording his rants, printing out toxic group texts, saving the photo of him shirtless in the freezer, that all hit a wall. Jessica. We tried to pull her in. I messaged her again. "He's a predator. Don't fall for it again." She replied, "You have no idea what game you're playing." And that's when I realized she wasn't brainwashed. She was playing him. And maybe playing me, too. Kayla didn't care. "Let her burn," she said. "We go public. Hashtag Denny Detox. I'll go on TikTok. I'll cry." I wasn't so sure anymore, because Bruce had started acting different. Not nicer, just quieter. Too quiet. He stopped yelling about carbs. He stopped grabbing people's arms. He started locking his office. He even stopped working the line. But Jessica, she started managing inventory. She made new shift schedules. She'd whisper into Bruce's ear like they were running some inside joke. One night, I stayed late to close and the freezer light was on again. But this time, Bruce wasn't jogging. He was curled on the floor, shaking. No shirt, just sweatpants. Like someone cracked his code. Sticky notes still lined the walls, but they were crossed out.
"Fat is failure?"
Lies.
"Jessica will come back.
She's here. She's worse. I stepped back quietly. The next day, Jessica brought cold-pressed juices for everyone.
On the house, she said, courtesy of Bruce's new meal plan. I'm helping him clean up. Mind, body, finances.
I smiled, but I knew what she meant. She had him. Entirely. The next week, Bruce was gone. Just gone. Jessica said he took emergency leave, but no one saw him pack. No goodbye. Just an empty office and a post-it stuck to the time clock. Don't contact me. Signed with a sad face. By then, Jessica had a clipboard and a manager badge. She rebranded the whole vibe.
Denny's Fit Fam, she called it.
Same shit, different queen. But worse, way worse. She brought back weigh-ins. This time with progress charts and anonymous shame boards in the locker room. She suggested we post weekly photos to a private IG page. Anyone who refused got worse shifts or no shifts. And suddenly, I was the target. She cornered me one day by the coffee machine.
You're still eating peanut butter, Lisa?
She asked, voice sugary but sharp.
It's just, with your frame, it shows fast.
I didn't flinch, but Kayla did.
She's lost her damn mind, Kayla said. It's the same madness, just with better eyebrows.
Kayla quit a week later, couldn't handle it. She said her body felt haunted by bee pollen. Me? I stayed. I had to. House rent is crazy these days. I kept my head down until Jessica got promoted regionally. Yep, the franchise loved her ideas. Modernizing the Denny's brand, they said. Wellness culture, female empowerment, social media integration. She left for Arizona, set up shop at another location, posted filtered selfies with captions like,
Boss energy only,
and
Don't let a man ruin your diet or your destiny.
She became a micro-influencer, 50K followers, some brand deals, a podcast. That bitch. This story was shared by one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers. She sent me the following email, quote, I used to work at this diner where, for a solid couple of months, everyone got obsessed with bee pollen. It started with one person claiming that it kick-started your metabolism through something they called thermogenesis. Basically, your body turning into a fat-burning furnace just by existing. Nobody could really explain how it worked, but suddenly it was in smoothies, teas, even sprinkled on salads like it was fairy dust. The vibe around food got weird fast. What didn't help was our manager. He had no filter and absolutely no sense of boundaries. If you ate something he didn't approve of during your break, like a cookie or a slice of pizza, he'd make some loud comment about your weight, like it was motivational or something. One time, he grabbed my arm while joking around, felt a little softness, and literally yelped like I'd shocked him. It was humiliating. The whole environment fed into this toxic cycle of quick fixes and shame spirals. People weren't getting healthier. They were just getting desperate.
We were supposed to have a beautiful honeymoon in Aspen, Colorado. My parents' rich friends offered us their cabin so we could save money after spending most of what we had on our wedding. Honestly, it was going to be a nicer honeymoon than either Jorge or I ever dreamed. It was a beautiful little cabin deep in the Rockies. It had not one, but two hot tubs. One was outside, and one was inside. Well, technically, one was a bathtub, but it had jets. So in my book, it was a hot tub. We planned to shack up all week, and during the day, we would enjoy what the mountains had to offer. We were going to ski, go tubing, ice skating, and more. It was going to be so romantic, but of course, it had to be derailed. On our way, a heavy snowstorm rolled in. Never have I seen a blizzard this intense. It was a complete whiteout. We couldn't even see the car in front of us. Jorge was leaning over the steering wheel, squinting his eyes, trying to see the road. Even with our brights on, we couldn't see anything. We had no choice but to pull over and wait for the snow to let up. After 30 minutes, the snow started coming down harder. We decided there was no way we would make it to the cabin, so we needed to find a hotel to stay at. As I started calling around to find a vacancy, I realized we weren't the only ones who needed to stop for the night because of the storm. I'm not super high maintenance, but I have a thing about cockroaches. So, I was desperate to find a place that wasn't a rundown motel. We came to this conclusion much later than most, so we had no choice. The only place we found was a Motel 6 nestled deep in an obscure mountain town. It was about 30 minutes down the road, according to Google Maps, but it took us an hour to get to the hotel. We had to move at a snail's pace so we wouldn't slide off the road. Jorge was relieved when he saw the neon blue Motel 6 sign amidst the white. I was filled with dread. In my experience, motels like this were always infested and gross. What a lovely way to start our honeymoon. We got our room keys and rushed into the room. The door was so light. It felt like reinforced cardboard, not the most secure. The room smelled faintly of pee. We could hear our neighbors on both sides. On the side by the TV, they were yelling at their kids to stop jumping on the bed. And on the other side by the bed, they were having loud, passionate sex. That could be us. I laughed and sat down on the bed. The jolt of my body sitting down stirred a couple roaches, and they ran out from under the bed. I screamed and jumped up on the bed, and more scurried out. I looked at my husband and said, "I'm not sleeping tonight. They're going to be crawling all over us." "I'll protect you," Jorge said with a smile. His soft smile and kind eyes calmed me. I went to use the bathroom, and I found the source of the pee smell. The pink tiles around the toilet and the shower had a yellow residue with dust sticking to them. The mirror was cracked down in the middle. I looked at the shower and wondered if someone had ever been stabbed in there like the movie Psycho. I came out of the shower and told Jorge, "I'm not using that shower either. Something is going to come up the drain." Jorge started to explain how he wasn't thrilled to be there either. "I was thinking," he said, "the storm might let up in a couple hours. I'm happy to drive through the night to get to the cabin so we aren't sandwiched between two passionate lovers and a strung-out family. That way, we can really enjoy our honeymoon." He came over to me, grabbed my waist, and pulled me towards him. "That's why I love you." We sat on the bed watching Family Guy for hours, but the storm never let up. It became pretty clear we weren't going anywhere until the morning. Jorge left to pick us up some pizza. While he was gone, I sat in the middle of the bed, holding my knees, anxiously scanning the area around me for bugs. Suddenly, someone tried to open the door. They turned the knob and shook the door. I almost spoke up, but I felt I needed to stay quiet. A silhouette appeared in the window. It was man-shaped. He held his hand to try and look through the window. It looked like he may have had a gun. I texted Jorge to be careful coming in because there appeared to be a man with a gun circling the motel. The man moved on, and soon Jorge was back with our pizza. We ate and then cuddled in the gross bed while watching Family Guy. Both of us succumbed to a light slumber. Around 2 a.m., the man came back. He started shaking the door more aggressively. He was yelling, "Hey, hello, anyone home?" He pounded on the door and the window. Each time his fist came down on the door, it looked like the door was just going to fall over. Jorge turned the light on by reflex, alerting the man that someone was inside. The man started pounding harder until he punched a hole through the door. "Jesus Christ!" Jorge said. He quickly got up, making sure I was behind him. "What do you want? We don't want any trouble." The man shoved his arm through the hole, and he was holding a gun. He fired off a round. Luckily, it didn't hit either of us. "Okay, no need to do that. What do you want?" Jorge repeated himself. "Money! Give me your money!" I took off my wedding ring just in case things got worse. I didn't want to lose it. Jorge went to his wallet and my purse to collect all our cash. The man shoved his head into the hole. His skin was pale and veiny. He had wild hair and eyes. He looked at me and he gave me a creepy smile. Most of his teeth were missing and the remaining ones were rotted yellow. "Hey, pretty lady," he said to me. Jorge turned around and barked at him to leave me alone. The junkie mimicked my husband and went back to staring at me with his unsettling grin. "I could show you a fun night, pretty lady," the junkie told me. much more wild than this vanilla piece of shit. Jorge waved a wad of cash at him. Here, this is what you want, right? I kind of want her too. Jorge started to get angry. You can have the cash. Put the gun down and back up so I can drop the cash outside for you. The junkie bowed away, and Jorge slowly reached his hand out of the door hole to drop the cash. Right when he let go of the money, the junkie fired off another round. The bullet went through the door into Jorge's thigh. Jorge! I yelled. Jorge fell to the ground. The junkie let out a weird little laugh and took off. Jorge's leg was bleeding badly, but finally, the snow was beginning to dissipate. I called 911, and we got an ambulance to take us to the nearest hospital. Jorge was okay, but we spent the first half of our honeymoon in the hospital. We still got to spend time in the cozy cabin, but what we could do was limited because of Jorge's injury. We decided at some point down the line to try to go on a honeymoon again. This time, we agreed to go somewhere warm, tropical place that wouldn't be cursed with the blizzard.